You're listening to Conversations on Strategy. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. Joining us virtually today is Brigadier General Shane P. Morgan, 56th Field Artillery Commandant at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I'm in the studio with U.S. Army Major Brennan Devereaux, National Security Researcher and author of Lessons Learned and Unlearned, The Drivers of U.S. Indirect Fire Innovation, published by Army University Press in February 2024. Congratulations on your new book, Brennan. Tell us a little bit about it.
This book was an opportunity to explore artillery. I came out of command. I found myself in grad school, and I think I did what most Army officers do in grad school, which is either write and research about World War II or about their branch. And I didn't want to do another project on World War II. So I looked at artillery, and specifically I looked at why we were where we were, which sounds kind of strange. I had come into the Army with these great myths and lore of the king of battle, and the weapons we had when I was deployed weren't really what I thought they were. We had shifted dramatically from what I had seen in the, you know, the big video before I branched artillery. And I was curious how we ended up with the systems that we ended up with. And so I did this big, long historical look at why we changed over time and how we ended up with the arsenal that we did. I measured three driving factors. This was the big push, which was, are we changing because of what we're experiencing in combat? Are we changing because there's some big, scary threat out there? Are we changing because there's, hey, look at this new awesome technology? And I found that it's not a direct answer. It changes over time. But more often than not, it was that big, scary threat, except when we were in the heart of the fight. And the heart of the fight drove us for a temporary period. And then after that kind of died down or the conflict moved on, we very quickly pivoted back to, hey, look out for the Soviet Union. Hey, look out for China. Look out for these things. And that created a weird gap, I think, for me as a junior officer, when I was in that time where there really wasn't that big, scary threat. And I think the artillery struggled a little bit with its modernization during that time.
General Morgan, did you want to weigh in on anything before we move on?
I just want to really applaud Brennan for taking on this project. And quite frankly, we need more of it to look at it through a historical lens and why we are where we are today, vis-a-vis where we were and where we want to go. So Brennan, I thank you for taking that on. And I'm certainly in a position to describe what we're doing at Fort Sill that might be different than your experiences. I think you'd be pleased to know what we're teaching. This is really, really important work, and I think it's got a larger purpose that will have a lasting effect.
Thanks, General Morgan. Brennan, what are some of the major takeaways from your project?
I think there's a lot, and I could probably take up the entire time talking about all the neat things I learned, the random facts. But I think there's five that really stand out for me that would be interesting to see how they're transitioning to where we're headed versus just the historical thing. And sir, the first one that really jumped out at me is the importance of the professional journal over time. And it ebbed and flowed, and there was times where it wasn't as important as it should be, and there was times where it didn't cover a lot of stuff, and there was times where it was incredibly important for the development and modernization of artillery, from talking about the mobilization and mechanization of artillery forces after World War I, through sharing TTPs in the Vietnam War. It really was a venue for soldiers and for the organization as a whole, I think, to overcome some challenges. I'm curious, as we look to the future, how the artillery branch is working to reinvigorate the artillery journal and what you see its role in as we're looking at some of the complex challenges we face today.
Yeah, Brennan, thanks. And you're familiar with both the Field Artillery Journal and the Field Artillery Professional Bulletin. So there's two separate professional journals, if you will. Without, you know, maintaining a degree of humility, because I was forced to do this, certainly for my first one, but I've been published three times in the FA Journal based on my experience as a battery commander in Afghanistan and then as a battalion commander, 12 to 14 timeframe. And you're absolutely right. So I've used the historical articles. One example, I think it was published in 1999. I used it as an LPD. It was called The Artillerization of the IPB. And so what is different for a field artillery unit to account for how you see yourselves, you know, vis-a-vis the enemy and the terrain? So I will share with you, that's kind of where we were at our highlight, I would say, through the 90s air-land battle. And then, of course, as you know, we got into counterinsurgency for 20 plus years. And we've never walked away from how we train combined arms maneuver, but the fight absolutely made us adjust and do some things that maybe field artillery, battery, or battalion isn't necessarily designed to do. So where am I going with this? If you look at those professional journals, we've published 32 articles last year. We are going to publish another 40 plus in the fall in this coming year. And we're seeing renewed interest from the field. So kind of the top-down planning, bottom-up refinement in our professional journals. I'd like to think we had a good process in place recently to encourage that type of feedback from our junior leaders especially. But if you look at the articles that are coming in, they really are getting us to relook, rethink, and to drive what we call relevant change. The FIRES Journal is more designed for thought-provoking, maybe outside-the-box ideas, techniques, things to consider, whereas the Professional Bulletin is more doctrinal, fact-based, you know, how we're fighting organized design today and making that work. I think our system and our processes is in a good place, but I do agree with you. The last article that I wrote for the FA Journal was called Getting the Guns into the Fight, and it was after my date rotation at the Joint Readiness Training Center, and it was buried in the very, very back of the publication. It is what it is, but there's a renewed focus on large-scale combat operations that's threat-driven, and we're seeing more and more articles being submitted from the force that we really, really encourage. And then maybe a little later, I can talk to you about what the Chief Staff of the Army has done with the Harding Project, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, but maybe not everybody on this podcast would. But I'll stop there.
Thanks, sir. That's great. Outside of the articles from soldiers, one of the things that was really interesting in the journal and then also just through other communications was the message from your position, from the Commandant, messages from the artillery school, and even messages from the Artillery Association. These were put out to the force as a means of showing and telling the force where the artillery branch was headed, as well as explaining some of the challenges they were going through when we were really working on gunnery challenges, when we're first really figuring out indirect fire, through what is the right caliber weapon we need. And these became very interesting and create a lot of good dialogue in the force, but at a minimum, they were kind of that guiding light for where we were going. I'm curious if you see the role, your role, the school's role, and the role of the association kind of continuing that as we look at, again, a very complex environment with what is the future of artillery as we look at the changing battlefield, and if you see those roles changing at all.
I've seen this evolve just in the positions that I've held over the last couple of years. I had the opportunity to command the Mission Command Training Program that does warfighter exercises where we train Army divisions and corps and Army Service Component Commands. We've been focused on large-scale combat operations, large-scale ground combat operations, LISCO, for, I would say, probably 6 or 7 years now in how we fight. And I would say that my date rotation, the decisive action training environment rotations that I had as a battalion and a BCT commander, we fought large-scale combat operations. And in large-scale combat operations against near-peer threat, named adversary, that's where we really see what field artillery is, can do, must do, and only can an artillery surface-to-surface all-weather fires, including HIMARS MLRS capabilities, rockets and missiles. Now you had to get on the edge of your seat there. So with that, we are teaching the fundamentals of field artillery that we've taught for many, many years. 5 requirements for active predicted fire. Shoot, move, communicate in order to survive. I would say that's one thing that I've added to rather than shoot, move, communicate, and survive in order to survive. And then with our focus on the fundamentals. As far as looking forward, we're very fortunate that we have the long-range fires cross-functional team here, long-range precision fires cross-functional team here, part of Army Futures Command. So where if you were to make a delineation between defining my role, responsibility, where I'm looking and his, if you look at the Chief of Staff of the Army's priorities for transformation, there's 3. Transforming contact, which is 18 to 24 months. I'm all into that for the fielded force that we have today. Deliberate transformation, 2 to 7 years. And then concept-driven transformation for the Army of 2030 out to 2040. So again, I bring you back to what has changed. We've gone back to the basics. We're doing manual gunnery here. We're able to operate in a comms-denied environment, you know, everything from graphical firing tables to graphical sight tables to Mylar paper, range deflection protractors, all those things that you are familiar with. We're absolutely teaching that right now because there should be no scenario in any environment that we cannot deliver massed concentrated fires, rockets, missiles, and HE. I'll stop there.
Thanks, sir. Definitely having some flashbacks to the charts and darts. I also almost yelled boom, boom when you said shoot, move, and communicate. I feel like it's been ingrained in me. I'll transition us a little bit to more the book and kind of the themes. I really looked at not just the history, which I found fascinating, but what were the driving factors and what were the change? And the two that ended up being really the driving factors for my research, minus a very weird period in the 1950s, was combat experience and the external threat. For most of the research, that external threat was the Soviet Union, only now kind of a resurgent external threat. I'm curious, as you're looking from your foxhole at where the artillery is going, how do you think we should and how are we balancing the potential combat experience we're gaining from the Ukraine war? And then I know we're not fighting it with that external threat of China, which can include the return of missiles. We're seeing an emphasis on long-range artillery and the need for precision strike.
Yeah, great question. And I'll start with the observations from the war in Ukraine right now. And I use the word observations purposely. If we look at what is coming out of Ukraine, certainly shoot and scoot that we'll hear commonly referred to for the employment of HIMARS, absolutely effective. M777s are working as designed, our towed 155 howitzer. Definitely getting some unique TTPs on their employment in terms of survivability. And I won't go into great length on that. But if there's one thing that's coming out of the war in Ukraine is that our equipment, M777A2, towed 155, 105 howitzers, heck, the Q36 and Q37 sensors, radars, and HIMARS, especially all combined, work as designed for today's fight for our fielded force. A lot of observations that now we need to put into the doctrine. I just would like to talk about what we are doing in terms of our doctrine. So gets back to large-scale combat operations. So FM30 operations published October 22. FM309, our capstone document, which is fire support and field artillery operations. And notice we put fire support in front of field artillery operations. It may actually go into some of your experiences, but every one of us is a fire supporter first, no matter which weapon capability that we're on. Rockets, missiles, radars, towed, self-propelled artillery. And then that published in 2019 with a focus on large-scale combat operations. And then, of course, 3.0 came out, and we now have completed our worldwide staffing on the update to our FM309. We'll go out next month, and you'll see some changes, but not really that many. If you look at where the Army went from unified land operations to multi-domain operations, we've accounted for it, but it was a pretty good document to begin with. We're pretty excited about that and the other 18 doctrinal publications that we have in the field artillery branch and the 3 training circular. Coming out of the Ukraine, I would say we're more or less validating our equipment and how they're using and being employed. But on the same token, we're never going to walk away from our tried and true, you know, foundational principles of the 5 requirements for active predicted fire. And we mass concentrated fires. I mean, that's what we do. I don't know. I haven't been there in Ukraine. Really, I don't know anybody who has firsthand experience that wears a uniform and have seen it through an artillery lens on a firing point. We did have a gentleman named Mr. Jim Lechner come and talk to us. He's an author, fought in Somalia, retired infantry officer, and he showed his firsthand accounts with his pictures. But that's really as close as I get to, okay, but are they doing the things that we would do and how we fight? I can neither confirm nor deny. I have my own assumptions, but I just know that how we teach and train is we mass cannon artillery fires, and there's nothing on the battlefield that can replicate surface-to-surface, all-weather cannon fires, and then when employed at echelon, at scale, the devastating effects of what HIMARS and MLRS platforms can deliver. So that's on the war in Ukraine. Where are we going? Always prepare for your most dangerous course of action, right? And if you look at the most dangerous course of action, it's a peer named adversary. That's our pacing challenge in the national defense strategy. We're ready for that fight. We're training for that fight. If we go forward in the future, what do we need? There was a strategic fire study in 2019, 2020, you know, and what came out of that? was, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but in the five multi-domain task forces, each of them has a long-range field artillery battalion. Each will have, you know, PrSM, and we can talk about the capabilities, but PrSM-capable HIMARS launchers, mid-range capability battery that will shoot SM-6 and Tomahawk missiles, and then a long-range hypersonic battery that will shoot at long-range hypersonic missiles. Pretty neat, pretty exciting for the field artillery. Now, as you shift over, we just completed a tactical fire study, and we have some conclusions that was based on our named peer adversaries and how we fight and correlation of forces and means and what we think we need going forward in the future. I will certainly always say we need more artillery, but there's some other pretty good conclusions that we're able to link to an analytical underpinning that will drive resources. We come up with the concepts, requirements, resources, those three come together, and then you get some lethal capabilities that we probably need. But I'll stop there.
Thanks, sir. And yet you could always use more artillery. I don't know any commander who would turn that down, right? You talked a little bit about the devastating capabilities, and I love that you alluded to the HIMARS and the MLRS. I am a rocket guy. I love the rocket artillery. Although it wasn't just rocket artillery, I did find throughout history there's been this continual need to improve lethality to be able to destroy anything on the battlefield, right? Artillery needs to be able to take anything out. At the same time, certain restrictions, whether that's political, whether that's technological, whether that's just a different need as we look at the push for precision, have seen some of those capabilities disappear. Our cluster munitions, nuclear artillery, I think we could all agree is, I'm glad that's no longer on the battlefield. Sense and destroy armor munitions. There's a lot of these that have kind of walked off the battlefield for one reason or another. And although artillery is still very lethal, there's a little bit of a gap there. And I'm curious how we're looking at that gap when it comes to, say, anti-armor munitions, potentially anti-ship munitions, and how do we balance that with a need and almost a responsibility for accuracy and precision as everyone is now watching wars and just firing a massive artillery into a town isn't really acceptable anymore.
Yeah, great question, great assertion, and agree. There's a time and a place for each of the munitions and capabilities that you described. I will share that concentrated massed artillery can't be replicated by anything else. But we still need certainly what we learned in 20 years of counterinsurgency, the need for precision-guided munitions. As our chief says, it's another arrow in our quiver as far as the capabilities to include what you just talked about, you know, maritime strike. So where are we going? Let me give you some concrete examples of what we're doing. It's called the XM-1180. X for anything is experimental. Hit to kill for our 155 millimeter delivered howitzer. So that's going to be able to engage not just a stationary armored vehicle, but even one that's moving because it's got the seeker on it. We've got the bonus round that was always served as a bridge to get to our CDAM hit to kill. And then we also have XM-1208, which is, again, experimental, which is going under UXO testing right now because, you know, one thing that we always do is we abide by the law of armed conflict and any other policy decisions that we operate. So to get under that 1% dud rate, and we actually have very favorable, encouraging, promising data right now where we're shooting at the propellant zone that we're shooting to get under that testing. So that will be those cluster munitions that we certainly need. So as you look at mass, HE, cluster, precision-guided munitions, there's a time and a place in large-scale combat operations for all of them. Now, there may not have been a time and a place in counterinsurgency operations or in an urban environment for mass concentrated fires, but you know, when we're fighting the fight that we anticipate, we must dominate and win. I'll stop there.
Thanks, sir. That was great. And I really like you kind of tease some of the technology aspects. In my research, technology never really drove the innovation process other than, like I said, a very weird time in the 1950s where if you weren't nuclear, you weren't relevant. I take that as an outlier, but technology was still always incorporated very well. And as we're looking at technology, it becomes very much the flavor of the month and these drastic assertions made in articles and commentary. I remember recently reading, you know, the tank is dead because of some new technology. I'm curious what we're looking at, if you could expand a little bit on where you're going with technological innovations and how we're incorporating them. Specifically, one that's really fascinating to me is loitering munitions and how we're using drones, whether to sense or drones as a strike platform in itself, and how that kind of fits into the artillery community, vice the maneuver forces.
I'm as fascinated and intellectually curious to that capability and the opportunities that we have than anyone. I'll tell you where I'm focused as the primary observer for a call for fire, be it an immediate suppression mission where, you know, the human is still in the loop in terms of human machine integration, but I'm leading with a aerial observer that's unmanned, that's given a firing battery in that quick fire kill chain, a 6 to 8 digit grid that we can shoot off. I think that's where we need to go. In terms of where we are right now, I think we've established the right proponency, if you will, but how do we get it to come together? Everything from robotics, ground robotics, to UAS, or quite frankly, I just want to call them drones. And I have this conversation with my team regularly. I would say not everybody in the military knows what UAS stands for, but every 15 or 16 or high school age or young man or woman knows what a drone is. Sometimes we confuse ourselves with our acronyms. So where are we going? And this is whether we call it a one-way attack, you know, platform, or if we call it a loitering munition, or if we call it a UAS. I think rockets down into the division, I think that you'll see that as we go forward, scalable from ranges that are relevant to a company's area of operation, to a battalion's, to a brigade combat team, to a division, and how they're employed in the close fight. Got to balance cost too, though, right? Will we ever mass, I don't know, swarm? I don't know. I think we're still wrestling with all this. The capability exists today. How do we employ it to get that asymmetric advantage in large-scale combat operations? I think that's what we got to figure out, continue to test and see what the right missile mix is, rocket mix is, if you will, munition mix. I'll stop there.
I appreciate the time. So those are my big takeaways and things to talk about. First, I want to thank you for sitting down with me to talk kind of where we're headed. And at the same time, I want to thank you for taking a chance to look at the book and the research and kind of see what one of the junior officers are thinking about the artillery and where we're headed. And would challenge people who are interested in learning about it to pick up my book. It's free, costs you nothing, so you're free to check it out. It's called Lessons Learned and Unlearned, The Drivers of U.S. Indirect Fire Innovation. Sir, do you have any questions of me? Anything you want to know about the research or where we're headed?
Thanks for taking this on. You're always welcome out here to come back out here. I'd love to have you out here talking to our Captain's Career Course because they got some great thoughts just like you do. Heck, we bring in everybody here. That's the greatest part about Fort Sill. Every incoming battalion and brigade commander comes out here for their pre-command course. We got weekly touch points on Mondays with the force. I have virtual sessions with the CTCs and their task force seniors. And most importantly, the Field Artillery Commanders Forum that I have with FA Brigade and Devardi and BCD commanders. I'd love to get you into one of those to talk to them because I think it would be good for them to hear what your research concluded and just gain an appreciation of what's on their mind as well. So it's not just coming from me.
Sir, I would love to take that opportunity. That'd be great.
Hey, and the last thing I'll close with is, and I mean this, I can make a irrefutable argument that there's never been a more exciting nor more relevant time than today to be a red light.
Before we close it up, though, Brendan, I'd love to hear what's next for you. What are you working on?
I have a pretty cool assignment here at the War College where I just get to research and write. So I'm doing a lot of small articles. I'm trying to get some other mid-grade officers, junior officers to write. So doing some little pieces like that. And then I have two bigger projects. One I just completed, personal account of my time during Operation Inherent Resolve, shooting rockets at ISIS, which I think will be a really interesting story to tell. And then I'm doing a bigger research project here about lethal autonomous weapon systems, the idea of the robots, the drones, as the general talked about, the drones having some more authorities, even the potential to decide and to engage a target on its own.
Interesting, for sure. General Morgan, just want to make sure you don't have any more concluding thoughts you'd like to share before we wrap it up.
As we drive relevant change, and we look at the three-legged stool for learning. You got the institutional domain, you got the operational domain out in the fighting force, and then you got the self-development. So, Brendan, keep encouraging those who follow you to publish, to write, be provocative. As long as it's threat-driven, I think that's where our sweet spot is on all strategies. We're focused on the threat. But the good ideas often come from, you know, we talk top-down planning, bottom-up refinement. Some of the best ideas come at the most junior levels. And just know that I'm open to it for the field artillery so that we can get just a little bit better. So in our next fight, we win 100-0 and it's 50-0 at halftime. So that's where we are, and always welcome out here. Good to see a red light continuing to do great things. So thanks.
What a great note to end on.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.